Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home services marketplace. And Angie is here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled professionals to get the job done well. My son needed a major yard cleanup at his new home. We went straight to the Angie website and found a bunch of local, reliable, and affordable pros to handle the job, and one did pronto. Angie can help you find the best price for your project. Angie lets you request and compare quotes from multiple pros in just a few taps, or book services at an upfront price based on local data. Angie has cost guides that tell you what others have paid for similar projects, both nationally and in your area. Get started at Angie.com. That's ANGI.com, or download the app today. The app and website are free to use.
Welcome to our listeners at the Victor Davis Hanson Show. This is the weekend edition where we step beyond current news stories and politics to look at things from the past. It's always a really exciting episode and my favorite, I confess, because Victor is a historian above all other things. He's a classicist too, so it always is very interesting. Today, we're going to look at Cortez's defeat of the Aztecs. Victor has written about that in a book called Carnage and Culture. And then we're going to take some time to look at the Benghazi incident in 2012 when the ambassador was killed and the annex, which was a station not too far from the ambassador's residence, had to defend itself. And we will be doing that after we hear a word from our sponsor.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable.
Welcome back, and I would like to remind listeners that Victor is the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow in Classics and Military History at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marcia Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. Victor, how are you doing today, by the way? And
very
this is
good.
The weekend edition, so very good. So good to hear it. I'm excited to hear your account of Cortez's defending himself and assault, I guess, as well, on Tenochtitlan to fight against the Aztecs and defeat them within 2 years. And then we'll take a look at Benghazi as some ex-military security personnel were forced to defend that annex for an entire night before they were able to get out. And I think that they're both remarkable for the incident that both of them had to fight their way out of, or at least defend themselves in a small enclave at one point. And they're both remarkable for the training of soldiers and just that expertise that these soldiers must have had, because the numbers were superior in both cases of the enemy assault. So let's start first with Cortez and the Aztecs and your account of how Cortez defeated the Aztecs in 2 small years. Very extraordinary, especially given that he came all the way across an ocean to do it.
We're talking about the invasion of Mexico from the Caribbean at Veracruz and the march inland between 1519 and 1521 by sort of lesser nobility, nobleman Hernan Cortez. And he's a very interesting guy. And I think, you know, he'd left in his teens to the New World, and then he'd I think he'd been in Cuba under the Velasquez governorship for a number of years. And then anyway, he raised the money and he had heard of fabulous wealth and a fabulous civilization in the inland of Mexico. But although there had been people who had seen it, nobody quite believed it. So he had almost no information. So he sailed the short distance from Cuba to Veracruz and he prepared to march inland. And he did. He had about 1,100 men. And the famous story that he burned his ships because it was either, you know, success or failure, but not retreat. And so the thing to remember about his conquest was it was probably absolutely impossible. We have Bernal Diaz's firsthand account, among other later accounts. So pretty much what happened, we have, at least from the Spanish point of view, there were two requisites. You had to have a military genius who had really no military experience to speak of before, like Hernan Cortez. He was a larger than life figure of Themistocles in his cunning and his ruthlessness as well. And then you could not have destroyed an empire of 4 million people had not you had the Tlaxcalans and the Tabascans and a whole series of the Totonacs, I think they were called, indigenous people who had been subject to Aztec oppression. And by subject, I mean they, in various wars of rebellion and unification on the part of the Aztecs, their people had been enslaved and brought to Tenochtitlan, Mexico City, and then sacrificed, human sacrificed in a horrific fashion. So there was a great hatred of the Aztec Empire. And Cortez manipulated that brilliantly. So even on the initial assault or entry, he had 1,000 Tlaxcalans with him. And then he went in and he had a very good propaganda that only a person that had horses or these huge Mastiff hunting dogs or Spanish steel blades or Spanish armor, highest quality steel in Europe, or gunpowder or cannons, or this strange language, or these priests, all of that had to be beyond the comprehension of Montezuma and the Aztecs, and therefore had to have a divinity element in it. And there had been reports how they got there to Veracruz. People in the Native American community had transmitted village to village that people had arrived on these godlike ships that had sails, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, anybody would think it was supernatural. But after a while, that novelty wore off, and there was a series of revolts, and Cortez then was faced with a two-pronged challenge. He had been recalled, on the one hand, by the governor of Cuba and by extension the crown, and Narvaez had had a huge force to attack him in his rear of Spaniards, and then the Aztecs were now onto him, and they were attacking him. So he retreated all the way back to Veracruz, left some of his men under very ruthless but brilliantly lethal commander Pedro Alvarado. And the long and the short of it is, after defeating the Spanish contingent, he won them over. And then he brought a huge force of about 2,500, got back to Mexico City, saw that it was an open rebellion and Alvarado had massacred, not that he hadn't himself. And there was a huge fight. And it's famously known as the Noche Triste, the terrible or sad night, in which about over half of his force, or at least about 1,000 people, were killed trying to get across the waterway. Remember, Tenochtitlan, Mexico City, was built on a lake. And so he had to retreat in utter defeat. He was almost wiped out. He got back and then he regrouped. Everybody thought he was over, done with, and he got a larger force. And this time he came up with a brilliant idea that he would be a maritime commander, that he would build lightweight ships and then label them, dismantle them, bring them over the mountains into Mexico's city's lake, reassemble them, and then fight on this sort of Venetian-like causeways and waterworks inside the city and destroy it. And he did. And he did all of that within 2 years. But the point I think you're making is that the asymmetry of the odds are staggering. I mean, he probably never had in the field at any one time more than 2,500 Spanish conquistadors, although he had hundreds, if not a few thousand indigenous people, but he was outnumbered. So how did he do it? And I picked this chapter in Carnage and Culture over 2 decades ago to show the advantages of the Western way of war. So he had superior technology. Steel was much better than obsidian. He had a military tradition that you find and destroy the enemy and annihilate them, in a Cloud Switzian terms, not you stun them and knock them out and tie them up and then transmit them back to Mexico City, pass them through the ranks for fodder for human sacrifice. That's a very inefficient way of fighting. They had horses. The enemy didn't. They had dogs. The enemy didn't. They had gunpowder. The enemy didn't. And even when they ran out of gunpowder, they were sitting on a veritable field of the ingredients of gunpowder. So they went up to volcanoes and they found sulfur and they found saltpeter and they created their own gunpowder. If they needed to make a bronze cannon, they found tin and copper. So they had that Western tradition of induction and the scientific method. And that gave them enormous advantages. It explained why Montezuma was not in Barcelona. He did not have the navigational equipment, the expertise, or the military dynamism to get there. But why a Spaniard, we're not talking about morality, and we're not talking about preordained history. We're just saying that all things being equal, the West had an advantage. It meant that they could have a bad commander, they could have bad weather, they could do stupid things and they could still win given their military traditions and their technology and their organization and discipline vis-a-vis the Aztecs. The Aztecs had no margin of error. Had they had a brilliant commander, had they unified the indigenous people, had someone been able to capture Spanish weaponry, and they did, and they could emulate them or fabricate them, and they could not, then it might have had a different outcome. But when you read Bernal Diaz's Conquest of New Spain, you want to read this hating Cortez because he's supposedly the archetypical European marauder, bandit, conquistador, forcibly introducing foreign religion to indigenous peoples, bringing with him everything from whooping cough to new strains of malaria to, of course, smallpox. But when you start to read about it, it becomes very complex. I mean, he's dealing with people who ritualize cannibalism, who ritualize human sacrifice, not just human sacrifice, but a magnitude that approaches maybe some of the death tolls at some of the minor, if I could use that obscene term, the satellite death camps of the Third Reich. I mean, we know from the Aztecs' own records that so many people were killed about 30 years before Cortez arrived and the bodies were dumped in Lake Tenochtitlan that people had to flee the city because of the putrid smells and infection that followed. And so when you start to see the dynamism there, the Aztecs were murderous people. And if today it's very odd for me to see a lot of the romance that surrounds them, especially in the Mexican-American community, when they have other indigenous peoples like the Tlaxcalans, that while they engage in human sacrifice, they did not institutionalize on a continental scale mass death, and they rebelled against it. And you would think that that would be a more suitable ancestor to choose if you were going to romanticize, you know, pre-Columbian Mexico. And then when you look at Cortez himself, it's very hard to see how he did it. I mean, he's pulled down from horses, he's clubbed, he's surrounded. He's got people trying within his own circle and cadre trying to kill him, to assassinate him. He's got Native American allies that decide to, you know, change sides and they almost wipe him out. He has the idea of ships. He has to build them. I mean, there's nothing the guy can't do, whatever you think about his morality. And then he ends up very badly in his late 50s. He's sort of stripped of all of his conquest, the spoils of war, so to speak. He goes back to Spain. There's a lot of anger and dissension and disagreement about his legacy among the Spaniards themselves, especially the Catholic Church. There's fights between his heirs about which property is which. And he ends up not a very happy, healthy, or well person. He dies in Spain in his early 60s.
Well, Victor, that seems like an extraordinary leader in Cortez and extraordinary endurance in the soldiers that came with them, the conquistadors that came with them.
They believed in, I think it's important, just as the Aztecs fought fiercely and they did believe that they would perish unless they got suitable numbers of live captives that they could sacrifice to the pertinent or relevant gods, whether that was for harvest or for release from sickness or for prosperity. And they needed to take out the beating heart, literally, of the body and show it to the throng that was assembled. They did believe in something as macabre as it is, but the Spaniards did too. They lived in the world. Remember, this is 1521 and were only about 30 years after the Reconquista and were after the Inquisition, but were also in the middle. I mean, Lepanto still coming up in 1571 and another 50 years. So the Spanish Empire is engaged in a lethal struggle with Islam in North Africa, especially, but in the peninsula of Spain itself. And it has created these Castilian warriors that by any fair measure were probably some of the fiercest warriors in the history of military conflict. Yeah. And they believed in certain things, that their duty was to save souls and spread Christianity for the benefit of their own soul and the benefit of souls yet not converted. And they believed that Spain, especially vis-a-vis France, but especially Britain, had a foreordained mission to bring civilization to where it wasn't there. It had a very different view of civilization than Britain or France, but nevertheless, that was their view. And they believed, because of the unique position of the Iberian Peninsula, that they had two missions. One was to make sure that Islam did not come through the Mediterranean and destroy Western civilization on their southern flank. And because they had Atlantic ports, they would discover the New World. Remember that those two phenomena were very closely intertwined. The reason that Columbus left Spain and Portugal and the successive explorers was they were convinced that Islam barred the way to transcontinental trade, that the old Silk Routes, whether it was through Afghanistan or Eastern Asia Minor, et cetera, on to China, India, were now impossible because of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire was dynamic, and it was taking the Balkans, and it was going to come into Italy, and it was going to come into Western Europe. And so they needed routes to China and India, and they had a theory going back to classical science that the Earth was round. So whether it was going down to the Cape of Good Hope, or whether it was going the other way, what would eventually be Cape Horn, whatever it was an idea that we've got to be independent and explore a new world and therefore seek autonomy and continue prosperity without worry of the Ottomans. But we have to keep the Ottomans out of Europe. And so it was successful. And that's that pressure allowed certain European countries that had Western ports, I say Western, but ports on the Atlantic, Britain, France, Portugal, Spain, the Netherlands. There's no accident that the focus of classical leverage, power, and influence went north. I know a lot of it's to do with the Protestant Reformation, but a lot of it's to do with the wealth and bounty of the New World. And they were particularly adept at utilizing it because they were ocean-faring peoples. And the people in the Mediterranean who had to fight Islam as a rearguard action, especially in Italy, they were galley-bound people. Yeah. And they were creating a type of maritime warfare that was dependent on the calm seas of the Mediterranean, rowing one or two masts only. And they were utterly unable and unprepared to go out in the Atlantic and sail in the way that the Spaniards, the Portuguese, or the French, or the British were, or the Dutch. And so it was kind of tragic. And so he was a member of that second generation of Spaniards who followed Columbus and were intent on magnifying the power of the Spanish crown, of Iberian civilization, Spanish language, and Catholicism against its perceived enemies, which were, you know, the Protestants, the Jews, he thought, the Muslims. The medieval and early Renaissance Spanish mind was sort of characterized as there's enemies on all sides of us. And we've got to go to the New World to get the resources to prevail back in Europe.
And oddly, they had the military talent, the technology, et cetera, to really master a huge part of the world in that 16th century in which they were conquering.
I think that was what we talked about. It is. And last time we talked about Italy, and I had a couple of emails say, how can you talk about, I was talking about that to another person, and how can you talk about the Italians as sophisticated people, given their dismal record in World War II, maybe not so much World War I, but that's a misreading of history. If you look at Venetian or Florentine or Roman Renaissance genius, they were the pillars of scientific excellence. And especially as it came to quality of cannon and firearms. You know, after the Battle of Lepanto, which was a crushing victory for the West, the Venetians, for example, looked at captured Ottoman cannon, and they looked at the metallurgy. And even though the Ottomans had copied Venetian designs, they said, we can't use it. It's not up to our standards that the cannons will blow up after an insufficient number of shots, and they junked them. So the Spaniards, and the same goes through with the quality of Spaniard metallurgy, especially steel and military tactics and the tercio. So because of their constant fighting with Islam in the Mediterranean and with one another, and until the Protestant Reformation and until the discovery of the New World, Western civilization was still a Mediterranean-focused civilization.
Yeah, it was.
And after that, it was no longer. You know, when you go to Eastern Europe today, and someone who lived in Greece off and on maybe for 3 years, and you talk to people, they still feel in a very strange way that Eastern Europe got a bad rap, not just the Cold War, or not just as Greece's battleground between East and West, but going back to the Byzantine Empire and the idea that certain people in Europe were the bulwark and slowed down Islamic aggression or Ottoman aggression and allowed Western Europe to have a buffer zone that would allow them to explore and become wealthy. And they're still sort of embittered because they became a garrison state in a way that the West, they feel, didn't have to be in the same way. They were more open to experimentation, religious diversity. As I said, the Renaissance, the Reformation, discovery of the New World, but the people in the old Byzantine Empire and what was left of it after its collapse, and it was under Ottoman occupation and was constantly fighting and rebelling, they feel they had, their only hope was doubling down. They had to be rigid. They had to have one orthodox religion. They couldn't leave. They had to fight and confront Islam from the East. And that 500-year struggle, even though it was mostly marked with defeat before the 19th century, they feel was successful in keeping the West safe. That's a different view.
Well, I hate to return to specific examples from all of those global issues, because I think the modern example that we wanted to look at, Benghazi, might not have so many global implications, although it might. But I would like to hear your commentary on how these ex-military, actually, security at the annex were able to, you know, defend themselves once again against superior numbers. I know that they probably, if they were here, they might feel like, well, we didn't succeed in saving the ambassador, which was an unfortunate thing in the Benghazi incident on 9/11 in 2012. But they were still extraordinary in their defense against the numbers in Benghazi that were trying to kill them. It was all a very strange situation. It almost reminds me sometimes of how that Noche Triste that Cortez's men fought themselves out of the city of Tenochtitlan, very similar. And that's why I wanted to pair those today. So,
well, they were similar in the sense that the four people, the ambassador and Sean Smith and the two ex-SEALs who died at the annex, but especially they and their associates, they were very Cortez-like, not in their aims or missions, but in their defiance of the great odds that were against them. And remember, they had a lot of things going against them. We got to remember, this took place on, that started on the anniversary of 9/11. So people knew, as there had been on most 9/11, there was a tendency in the Islamic world for riots and for uprisings against so-called colonialists, i.e. Westerners, like embassies or annexes or perceived CIA groups. That was number one. Number two, what were we doing there? That was another controversial situation because the Gaddafi family was in the process of reform. Not that Muammar Gaddafi, being a murderous thug, was capable of it, but he had westernized autocratic children, and they were starting to reach out to the West, and they were doing things like, let's open up Sabratha or Leptis Magna to archaeological discovery and reinviting Italians in, or bringing in cell phone companies, or taking areas that were rich in natural gas and allowing European companies to exploit them, or telling the Maltese that you can build the Corinthian Hotel in downtown Tripoli and have actual sovereignty to it. So this was a very fluid and promising situation for the first time in, you know, 40 years in Libyan history, since the mid-60s, late 60s. And then we went in there and got caught up with this missionary, Hillary Clinton, Susan Rice, Samantha Power. We're going to ride the wave of the Arab Spring and bring the Upper West Side or Berkeley to all of these places. And it was disastrous. So we went in there and created chaos with the bombing with the French. And then we removed Gaddafi without any idea who would replace him, or that his children had been serving as a transitionary movement, perhaps. And we created chaos. And then 9/11 came, and there was an uprising, supposedly in Egypt. And supposedly it was over a video, and supposedly the video was a Coptic or Coptic-related renegade filmmaker that had been on minor probationary status in the United States, and he made a video that was very critical of Islam. And this was an election year, Sammy. Remember that Barack Obama, September, October, November, it was less than 90 days, just 2 months, essentially, and he was going to be up for re-election. If you look at the polls, they were dead even. So factor all that together, what these few people were up against. And how does that factor out? It was in the interest of the U.S. government not to allow this mess that they had created to get out of control. And so one thing they did, not listen to warnings and beef up security, because to do so, they thought would invite further aggression in an election year. They had about a 12-hour window that there had been forces in Sicily, even drones, armed drones. They didn't send any of them there. When the CIA-related people, the contractors and the ex-SEALs came from Tripoli, they did it almost on their own spontaneous, innovative idea. And they, I think they even paid $30,000 or so dollars to commandeer this jet and to fly there. So yeah. The long and the short, you're talking about 10 or 15 people at most in the annex after failing to save the ambassador and Sean Smith and being run over at the so-called embassy. Then they went a mile away at the annex, and it was sort of like Michael Walsh just talked about, last stands, about heroic people at Thermopylae, the Alamo, et cetera, for whatever reason, are able to create feats of impossible daring and courage. And in this case, it was successful. They held off hundreds, if not thousands, of attackers at that annex, and they allowed the 30 or so people in the CIA to survive, and eventually, within a few hours after the hostility ceased, to get out to the airport and get home, and they lost two of them. But they didn't get any help when they should have had help from American military forces that were either inept or were not allowed to send somebody the 3 or 4 hours that would have taken to get somebody a team or two. And remember when they said, well, we didn't have time to get the adequate force. These guys had no adequate force. It didn't matter. When people heard that the embassy was in trouble, they just went over there, and they were outnumbered from the beginning. When they heard that the annex was going to be in trouble, they went back there and they were outnumbered, and they fought tenaciously. And they were up against all sorts of, I don't know who Ansar al-Sharia was. I only remember the name because as a farmer, there used to be a pesticide called Ansar. It was arsenic laced, as I remember, pretty powerful. And it's outlawed now, probably, but we used it a lot. And my point is, this strange Ansar al-Sharia We don't know whether it had Al-Qaeda affiliations or not, but it was a premeditated attack. And that was against the narrative of that election year. In other words, the Obama administration did not want a narrative appearing that there were warning signs that their embassy and annex were undermanned and there was going to be an Islamic attack on them. And they, for reasons of political utility, did not beef up that presence, or when that presence proved in actuality to be insufficient, then swarmed in reinforcements and had a big incident right before the election. And they might not have wanted as well people to ask, well, what in the hell was there a CIA annex anyway in this mess of post-Gaddafi Libya? And maybe it was to do what? To round up all of the dangerous weapons that Gaddafi had acquired and to buy them and then to give them or get them out of there? Or were there other NATO allies, maybe Turkey, that were involved somehow and to stop some of that? So there was a lot of exposure in an election year and they did not want that. And so what did they do to prevent that? And this is very important because we never really gave them for all of the investigations. I think there were six investigations. My view, they were all poorly conducted. Yeah. But nevertheless, we didn't give them any support for these various reasons. And then after they perished and we tried to find out how the four were killed and what was the text to it all, we were lied to. Susan Rice, remember, infamously went on television five times and swore up and down that this was a spontaneous riot due to some right-wing video maker who had offended Islam and who had kind of, you know, earned this animus, and they were trying to do their best in America. They jailed that guy on a trumped-up probation charge. And so their narrative was the right wing in America caused these deaths by creating a Islamophobic environment that swept the Middle East. And there was this thing in Egypt and protest in Damascus and everywhere else. And Benghazi was therefore. And that was a lie. It was a lie in this sense that whatever was going on elsewhere had nothing to do with these premeditated attacks by shock troops of Ansar al-Sharia, who brought in mortars, heavy machine guns, and they coordinated the attack on the annex and the embassy. And it was not a spontaneous riot in reaction to a video, as Susan Rice and others had claimed. And so in that context, these people were not going to get any help from the administration. They were not going to get any psychological support later, those who survived. They were not going to be seen as heroes. They were going to be seen as, you know, people in the wrong place, the wrong time. And, you know, the right did this to you because they allow this video maker to do this. And then we're going to have an election. And of course, the right wanted to make hay out of it. So we got that testimony by Hillary Clinton, you know, that really infamous remark. What difference does it make if they were killed in a spontaneous riot or if they were killed in a premeditated? Well, it makes a lot of difference because if it was premeditated and you had knowledge and there had been requests to beef up security, and then these men might have had adequate resources to enhance their last stand, as brave as it was, and maybe nobody would have been killed. Yeah. But it was a sad day, but it can't be seen separate from the context of the election year. And what was even more disturbing about it was we had, and I don't want to mention names, but we had high-ranking officials in the military and the intelligence community who, when they were brought in to testify, whether secretly and it was leaked or openly, parroted that administration narrative. And to parrot that narrative, you really had to say that a bunch of guys were rioting all over the Middle East because they were mad at the American right and the Islamophobia. And then somebody said, hey, I happened to get a GPS mortar. You did? Well, how the hell do you use it? Well, I don't know. Anybody can use it, learn it in 4 minutes. Wow. We just shot the annex. And we killed, you know, I think his name was Tyrone Woods. He was a heroic and Daugherty. Was it Glenn?
Yeah.
Daugherty and Tyrone Woods. We killed these two brave people. It was just a lucky shot. We've never used them. And there were actually people who testified to that, that said, oh, anybody can use them in very little time to be trained. That's absurd. And we had, remember that guy, Carney, Jay Carney, the press secretary, he went out there and just flat out lied. Susan, you know, this was a spontaneous riot. So these guys had nothing going for them other than their own courage. And they were not bent in a Cortez-like mission on gold and glory and et cetera. They were bent on trying to preserve human life and their American fellow Americans. And they were trying to save the ambassador. And everybody loved the ambassador in Libya. Yeah. And he was a benign, a good figure, benign as far as they were concerned for our purposes. He was a wonderful ambassador. And Sean Smith was a very loyal companion. And how they died, the manner in which they died, and the reason they died, people still to this day think it could have been preventable. Yeah. But had we not had Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty and the other groups of small number with them, they would have been completely wiped out.
Yeah. Well, Victor, let's have a word from our sponsor, and then we'll talk a little bit about maybe the technology or the soldiers' training. That's what I'm more fascinated with in the West. So we'll be right back.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back. And Victor, I wanted to ask you about the, you know, sometimes we see these training, for example, of Al-Qaeda or, you know, other militaries that are not Western, and they don't look quite like they could do what the men in Benghazi were capable of doing with all of their specialized knowledge and tactics and strategy and where to position themselves in the annex and the different types of weaponry they have. And the, you know what I mean? Like really specialized. I find that I think our culture really admires people who get that specialized and who can really anticipate what the enemy is going to do and that kind of thing. And we don't see that in these non-Western societies, soldiers trained so well like that, which, you know, thank God we can, you know, use the superiority in our soldier training. And I was wondering, you know, because you can give those Libyans all the military arms that the annex people had, but they would have still lost against those guys in the annex.
To start with the idea, you know, I wrote Carnage and Culture about this very topic, and it was severely criticized, but I don't think it was refuted. And remember what the theme of that book was. And I used 10 iconic examples, things like Rorke's Drift or the Battle of Salamis, except usually when Westerners were outnumbered. It didn't mean that the West was always going to win, and they didn't against non-Westerners. And there were a lot of disasters. But what it meant was, it being the Western military tradition, it gave them advantages to fight in unfavorable landscapes at great distances with enormous logistical or numerical disparities. And what was that it? Well, it was about 7 or 8 things. It was the classical tradition starting in Greece and Rome of inductive thinking and empiricism, that you had a scientific tradition that was not censored by religion or fable or custom or tribal concerns. And it can be very destructive. And so what I'm getting at is most, not all, but almost all of the great leaps and bounds in military technology were Western, whether it was gunpowder that was imported as a firecracker from China, and then it was used in a very sophisticated manner with, you know, corn, gunpowder, and metallurgy advances, so that very soon the Chinese were trying to buy gunpowder weapons, even though they had found gunpowder at least before the Westerners. So the West had this ability to make superior weaponry because of its scientific tradition, or borrow elements from other groups and improve upon it. And today, that tradition remains. So the Chinese say that they have a superior civilization and much more venerated and with a longer pedigree. Maybe so, but if you look at Chinese soldiers and weaponry, you can argue that the entire basis for their missiles, for their automatic weapons, for their new aircraft carrier is all westernized. Same is true with Japan, the same is true with South Korea. So people, when they westernize, they use American, European, or Western weaponry, and they improve on it if they can, but they improve on it in a Western fashion. And then when you look at the discipline, what you're talking about, that goes back to the phalanx and the legion and the tercio and the Renaissance. And it basically suggests that the warrior cult of scalping or getting, counting how many people you kill, or individual feats of bravery, or hit and run attacks, or night marauding is not, or cavalry marauding mounted troops is no replacement for infantry, men on the ground in formation, in which your bravery is assessed on the basis of how well you kept the line, the phalanx, the legion. That is how well you protected the man on your left or right, and you created group solidarity, and you followed orders. And so once you could establish that system and you could inculcate those values, then that also, along with the technology, gave you greater advantages. And when you mix into the context free market capitalism, then that meant not only that you have the scientific and military tradition, but you had the wherewithal, the labor and capital to send these forces, whether it's Kitchener all the way into Africa to avenge the death of Chinese Gordon, or the British Army into Zululand, or, you know, fight the Boxer Rebellion in a way that not since the Ottomans did any non-Western power have an ability to get into the heart of Europe, which at that time was trisected between Orthodoxy, Protestantism, Catholicism, and was divided, but in a way that Islam was united. But what I'm getting at is, so there was this military tradition of discipline and a definition of courage as following orders in service to the order and the formation. And there was a military tradition and scientific tradition that gave you superior weaponry. And there was an economic tradition that gave you a greater chance to have be better supplied. And that, and I could go into other things, but there were other auxiliary traditions. That explains, as I said, why Cortez was successful in Mexico City in a way that Montezuma would have failed had he gone to Madrid. He couldn't get to Madrid. And by the same token, in the middle of the Civil War, where 700,000 Americans were killing each other, you would think that Native Americans, all of the Western tribes, would unite and say, you know what, we can take St. Louis now. But they didn't. Because there was no sense of political statecraft in the way there was in the West of nationhood, the word nation, natio, that didn't really exist in the same way among non-Western peoples. None of this meant that necessarily the West was morally superior. It didn't mean that victory was preordained. It didn't mean that there would be stupid commanders. It didn't mean when you're faced with a Saladin or a brilliant non-Westerner, you wouldn't lose. It just meant that you had options to deploy forces all over the world in engagements. Maybe it wasn't wise to be there, but you had an option of winning. And that was not the same. That was not true of people who did not have capitalist economies, that did not follow the Western scientific tradition, and did not define courage and battle by Western notions of discipline and formation and chain of command. And so that's what it was about. And you can really see that the difference today. It doesn't mean that the United States is going to win in the streets of Baghdad, or they're going to win in Kabul. It means one of two things, that they have the ability to get over there. And if they want to fight a Western way of war, like they did in Fallujah, they can win. But at what cost, and in what cost to benefit analysis, is it worth it? What do you get when you destroy Fallujah? and you destroy the, you know, the Al-Qaeda or the Ba'athist who were there, rather than, you know, do COIN and counterinsurgency and all of that. And same thing with Afghanistan. The United States had the firepower and the organization and the money and the science. Had they wanted to take over Afghanistan, they could have done it. But for what purpose? What moral purpose? What practical purpose? What military purpose? What political purpose? And so they are very adept and flexible. Our counterintelligence and counterterrorism and asymmetrical forces, whether they're Delta Force or Green Berets or Ranger, whatever special elite forces they are, they can fight Al-Qaeda's type of war. Al-Qaeda can't fight our type of war.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that we should fight it. And it doesn't mean that we're going to do as well when we fight their type of war. So most of the story of the 19th and 20th centuries is non-Western people drawing Western forces in to asymmetrical conditions and landscapes where they're A, outnumbered, B, the local population is hostile, C, they have enormous lines of logistical challenges, and D, they don't have enough of their superior weapons of, you know, to make a difference, and then making them fight on terms of the host. And when that happens, they can lose. But it doesn't mean that the enemy can do the same. They cannot go into the West without becoming the West and defeat the West. So whatever we think, no Iranian army is going to land the United States. And if the Iranians are going to defeat Israel, it's because they're going to get weaponry from the Chinese or North Koreans that are copied from Western designs through trade or espionage. Yeah. And universities in Beijing, at least for a while longer, will not have the same traditions as Caltech or MIT. Not saying, or Georgia Tech or something. That doesn't mean that our universities are becoming more mediocre and less scientific and more weaponized and political. They are, and they're catching up, but we'll see. For now, we're the inheritors of the Western military tradition, and that explains why our brave soldiers did so well in Benghazi, and it explains why conquistadors could do so well in Mexico City. It wasn't foreordained. It's just an advantage that Westerners have.
Yeah. And there's something in the culture that you get so many of these young men that are so talented and so well trained in everything that they need to do, what to anticipate.
And there's a great misinformation that's given about soldiers and soldiers' families. It's very tragic because we are in American decline, I think, now, and one of its cultural decline. And one symptom of that cultural decline is a insane fixation on race, and not even race that's fundamental. I mean, we're all Americans. I don't mean that people who look different from one another have very different customs and traditions, even though we have the largest number of immigrants in the world per year. What I'm talking about is superficial manufactured anger among different groups. It's kind of like fighting over the chairs on the Lido deck. It's this anchor person wants that job from that anchor person. This diversity czar wants to be vice provost. This actor wants 7 commercials rather than 4. It's mostly among our elites. But in this conundrum, when you have the Secretary of Defense, getting back to military matters, and he says that he's going to ferret out white supremacists, and he's in a racialized climate, and he's giving lectures about that the American military will look in every aspect like America. And then you have General Milley with his, you know, looking over his shoulder to make sure he's not fired for, I think, legitimate reasons, saying that he's reading Professor Kendi and understanding white rage, when they both deep down inside know that there is not a conspiracy of white people in the military. If anything, it's interested in transgenderism and allowing transgendered people fairness. It has it goes out of its way to make sure that pregnant women can continue to operate in the military. It makes sure that gays can be married and be gay openly. It makes sure that through affirmative action programs that people who are so-called marginalized or non-white have some consideration that's favorable when their promotion and attention. Okay, so if you're going to go down that route, why would you not realize that there is also a tradition among the American muscular classes of the middle and lower classes, especially to want to fight for their country. I don't know if it's a Scotch-Irish heritage or what it is, but there are families in the middle class that generation after generation after generation, their children join the military and deliberately gravitate toward elite combat units. And the same is true of the Hispanic community and the Marines. I can tell you that so many people went to high school, volunteered to go to the Marines. But when you look at the death, and we've talked about this a number of times, the deaths, if you want to go and use the calculus of the left and say, we're going to look at everything through the lenses of gender and race, and you look at, you know, 35% of the country are white males, and they're dying at over, well over 70% in Iraq and Afghanistan. And yet you're going to target those people, and you're going to say, these are negative people. These are suspect, rather than saying, why is that? Yeah. Why do these people continually volunteer? And why do they die in inordinate numbers in god-awful places like Afghanistan, like Iraq, like Libya? Why do they do that? And why do young first, second generation Mexican-American kids really want to join the Marines, which is another frontline combat unit? And we don't do that. Instead, we just try to divide each other and then demonize supposed white males. And so what I'm worried about is, if you do that enough, and it's part of the larger environment where you're from Kyle Rittenhouse to this parade where you're saying that all white people are evil. And that's what a person like Joy Reid is doing when she celebrates diminishing white demography. Or she keeps saying white supremacy, white supremacy, white this, whiteness, whiteness. And they all do that. All of these anchors do that on those channels. Then if you're going to so demonize them, maybe they'll just say, okay, I'm not going to be in the military anymore. And who's going to step up? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe we'll have, I think maybe the left should say, you know what? White males are so toxic. And after Secretary Austin is done with his investigation, and after General Milley has gone through the rosters, they have determined that in the way that the Obama administration, I think it was Janet Napolitano or someone said that the chief threat for terrorism is returning veterans from Iraq. Okay, so maybe we've determined that this is not a demographic we want to entrust with our security. So then I'm going to say, then who's going to take up the slack? Is it going to be women? Is it going to be gays? Is it going to be, you know, we're identifying people by their race and gender, not my preference, the way the left does, though. Are going to be African-Americans? Are they going to have this huge, diverse military that's going to be overwhelmingly in combat and will die at the numbers of the people they replaced did in god-awful places like Fallujah or Taji or Kabul or Kandahar? We'll see. But right now, just as an observer looking at it, I think it's absolutely suicidal for the top echelon of the U.S. Air Force, Navy, and Marines, and Army to denigrate and cast under suspicion white males who for generations have volunteered to serve in the most hazardous positions in the U.S. military on behalf of their country and got very little monetary recompense for it and did it for love of country and tradition. And why you would want to denigrate that tradition, I don't know. Yeah. I really don't know.
It's not a good path ahead in that. But I would like to say that here on this show, we're not denigrating that. In fact, we're celebrating and we are very thankful for the training of our soldiers and the soldiers throughout the military. And so I think that we want to mark that on this Thanksgiving weekend. Victor, we have to go. We're at the end of our time. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me and thank everybody for listening again. I hope I didn't get off on too many tangents, but this area about military technology, last stands, East and West, I've written a lot about, and I get kind of frustrated sometimes when I feel there's so much false knowledge and false information promulgated in the public square by the media.
Yeah. All right. This is Sammy Wink and Victor Davis Hansen, and we're signing off.
Thank you.